viewpoint. They, of course, people like that traditionally have around the world have seen, working class people have seen the Russian Revolution as a massive step forward for people like them. You know, massive step forward for working class people, massive step forward for women, massive step forward for LGBTQ people, you know, massive step forward for colonized people, you know, oppressed nationalities, all those things, which the October Revolution broke through that oppression, which before that had seemed almost invincible. I mean, like, you know, there had been no successful, like, anti-colonial struggles before 1917. But the best you had was, like, in the 1890s, like, Ethiopia preserved its independence from Italian conquest, the Battle of Adowa, and examples like that. But, I mean, overwhelmingly, I mean, like, the colonial empires, they dominated the world. And 1917, all of a sudden, this huge crack in that facade took place and showed that a better world, a new world, was possible. A world free from these inter-imperialist wars, which had consumed millions of lives by 1917. And a world free from colonization and colonial exploitation and plunder and all that. You know, there was a world where oppressed and working people could take control of their own destiny for themselves. And that is huge. That example was massive. And what it was able to do was basically irreversible. Even though the Soviet Union isn't there anymore, its legacy still is. And it's still inspiring struggles to this day. You know, so that struggle still has now time, in the words of historian, Marxist historian Walter Benjamin. It's very, very relevant today for people who are trying to fight for change in the world now. So what I'd like to do right now, I'm going to play a talk by Michael Parenti, as I usually do every week. And this one is entitled The Struggle for History. And this is where he talks about, like, how the struggle to define history is such a huge part of politics and of struggle for change and struggle for liberation. You have to push back against the dominant narrative that is pushed on us by the by mainstream culture, which is really basically a corporate culture, capitalist culture, which is imposed on people. And, you know, you get it everywhere. And pushing back against that is very difficult. But people do it. People were doing it in 1917. They were doing it in 1905. They're still doing it now. And people can fight back, and they can win. They can tell the truth about what actually takes place in history and cut through the distortions. Once again, working people can take control. Working class and oppressed people can take control of their own destiny. And they can write history for themselves. Please stay tuned to Back in the USSR.
Thank you very much. It's such a fine turnout, it almost makes the place feel cozy. What I'm going to talk about tonight is a little different from some of the other things. I want to talk about something other than the headlines of today. I'd like to discuss a rather academic subject, which is history. Even more academic than that, the study of history and the production of history. I want to talk about things long past, yet very much with us, which is why some people talk about the living past, you know. And I think the study of history is not only a discipline, it is itself a political act, and it's part of the political struggle. The people who control this society, the people who control the dominant communication universe, they know this, and we ought to know it, too. Investigations of the past are usually motivated by something more than trying to find out what happened in the good old days. The effort to define the past is part of the struggle to control society itself. And if so, then the study of history is much too important to leave in the hands of historians. And nor is it ever left in the hands of historians exclusively. I mean, along with historians, for better or worse, are all sorts of people, including political leaders, publicists, press pundits, clergy, textbook publishers and school teachers and others, are all involved in the manufacturing and marketing of a history whose function quite often is not to enlighten, but to indoctrinate. The term history refers to both the actual course of events and the study of those events. I'm going to hear mostly, as I said, concerned about the writing and dissemination of history. But the distinction between these two is not absolute. Excuse me. Those who write history actually have an impact upon it. Their observations affect the things that are being observed. So the process of observing and defining affects the things that are being observed, affects our definition of them, and affects how we act upon them, or don't act upon them, or don't even know about them. They help control history's course by defining its dominant themes and influencing our understanding of what happens. Conversely, those who make history, especially those who occupy elite policy positions, often manipulate the materials needed for recording it. They will destroy or repress information. They'll introduce distortions at the point of production or at the point of origin, well before the history is even written or even played out. I remember what Winston Churchill once said to his Tory associates. He said, "Gentlemen, history will be kind to us because I plan to write it." And by the way, with that same intent, all sorts of political leaders, with that intent and with the $2 million advance they get from the publisher, all sorts of political leaders hurry forth and produce their memoirs to justify their policies and positions and manufacture official histories. This process of controlling history at the point of origin is not left to chance, but it's pursued systematically by policymakers and official agents. By the way, any researcher who ever works in government archives, I spent a year in the National Archives in Washington, D.C., are you struck by how many documents are missing, how things aren't available? Some things have never been cataloged. Many things remain classified for 50 years. I was talking to Morris Morley. Morris Morley's a fellow political scientist. He teaches at Macquarie University in Australia. And he's a friend of mine. And I saw him in Washington. He was in Washington looking at the Jimmy Carter records of... His expertise is Central America. He collaborates a lot with James Petras. I said, "Well, Morris, did you uncover some real good stuff?" He said, most of it is still just classified. 20 years later, we cannot critique Jimmy Carter's policy in Central America because the documents aren't free. It's worse than that. The War Department records on the Lincoln assassination conspiracy were kept secret for 60 years. They were finally placed in the public domain in the 1930s, after all possible conspirators were pretty much gone. Theodore Roscoe, he was researching the murder of Lincoln. When he was doing it, he discovered that some Civil War records in the U.S. Army intelligence were still classified almost 100 years after the war. 100 years they were still classified. Now, what question of national security could be involved here? I mean, how many Confederate spies are lurking behind the Union lines in 1960? Roscoe was writing 1960. There's the famous and utterly disastrous Battle of Passchendaele in World War I, also known as the Third Battle of Ypres, in which the British commander Sir Douglas Haig sent an entire army to its destruction in order to advance 900 yards deeper into an indefensible bog. In fact, the Germans retreated to let him take the bog because it didn't be perfect. The German mustard gas surprise attacks at Passchendaele was so devastatingly successful that British Army records were virtually stripped clean to conceal the truth from the British public. Official histories put British casualties at a fictional 238,000. Probably closer to the truth is what General Haig himself said right after the battle, his horrified private admission. My God, have we really lost 500,000 men? I mean, even the standard conventional hack reference books, Langer's World History Encyclopedia, which I have at home, I looked it up, even they said 400,000. So the point here, that the Brits took 400,000 casualties at the Third Battle of Ypres. The point here is that this battle was fought in 1917, and they're still lying about it. Most of the statistics and other documentation still remain a secret in the United Kingdom. Dennis Winter, who wrote a book about Haig and did some investigation into this, he found better archives in Australia and Canada. See, some of the documents hadn't been cleaned out. Some of the hadn't been cleaned out as thoroughly there. When he wrote his book on Haig, he found all sorts of funny things started happening. And this guy was writing in 1988, 89. In 1989, suddenly command records disappeared, minutes and memos disappearing, documents evaporating in thin air. The cover-up by Haig and the British High Command began the first year of the war in 1914, and it continues into 1989-90. You know, he even found in Haig's, the diaries that Haig kept, that he actually bought a whole other set of notebooks that had the same year as these notebooks, and he would tear pages out and then put pages in with a new date, which showed him prescient. You know, he'd say, I believe the Germans might try this and this. And this. Amazing and all this stuff. And you could tell that these were the pages put in because the carbons were missing. And Winters points out that this guy was, in the middle of the war, fabricating history, fabricating his own diaries, you see, to make himself look like a genius instead of the fool that he was. A more important example, which doesn't involve the incompetence and venality of a particular institution like the British High Command, but the power of a dominant class, is offered by the historian Carol Quigley. For 20 years, Quigley studied the Cecil Rhodes, Lord Alfred Milner, Oxford Group, the Round Table, as we call them. They had that official publication, the Round Table. The Round Table, which had such a decisive influence on British policy from 1891 right through World War II. And Quigley himself, by the way, was very close to establishment elites in this country and in Great Britain. After teaching at Princeton and Harvard, he spent the rest of his career at Georgetown School of Foreign Service. He was a consultant for the Brookings Institution, the Pentagon, the State Department. If he wasn't CIA, he was very close always to the policy circles and types that were. And not surprisingly, Quigley, by the way, was in total agreement with most of the policies of the roundtable elites. But he was bothered by some of their methods, and he thought their inherited wealth and power held terrifying implications for democratic governance. This is what he said, quote, "No country that values its safety should allow what the Milner Group," that's Lord Milner, the roundtable, "what the Milner Group accomplished in Britain, that is, that a small number of men should be able to wield such power in administration and politics, should be given almost complete control over the publication of the documents relating to their actions, should be able to exercise such influence over the avenues of information that create public opinion, and should be able to monopolize so completely the writing and teaching of the history of their own period." Unquote. But does that sound familiar, by the way? The suppression of history, the JFK assassination papers. Now, here's an issue that's been settled. The case is closed. There's nothing to hide. And yet the archives aren't open. A government that says there is no case, has nothing to hide, yet hides all sorts of things, including Lee Harvey Oswald's tax returns. We want to just find out who was paying him those years, how he managed to live. Can't get that information still to this day. His links to military intelligence, the disappearance of documents, the disappearance of JFK's brain, the disappearance of testimony of witnesses, and the disappearances of the witnesses themselves, or the odd, strange deaths of them. The examples of how history has changed and distorted, suppressed, fabricated at the point of production are, brothers and sisters, too numerous to record. We see it all the time happening before our very eyes. Lieutenant Colonel Oliver North, that vignette of him shredding documents while the FBI was right there in the office next to him, lackadaisically thumbing through the files at the, not saying to him, hey, don't shred those documents. We see the fabrication of the point of origin just last week, didn't we? The canonization of Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon, the saintly president. And to see representation after representation, image after image, and not a mention of the fact that this Richard Nixon carpet bombed Cambodia and Laos and Vietnam, leading to the death of tens of thousands of people. Brutal B-52 carpet bombings, relentless bombings of them, escalated that war and pursued it and prosecuted it with a savagery that made LBJ look mild. Not a word about that. They just said he inherited the Vietnam War and then finally ended it in 73. The great statesman of peace. Not a mention of his destruction, his murder of democracy in Chile, the murder of Salvador Allende, a dedicated democratic president, the backing of a deranged murder machine of the Chilean military. Not a mention of it. Didn't hear a word. But we heard he wasn't perfect. He wasn't perfect. He made mistakes at Watergate. Mistakes? A felony break-in is a mistake? Use that the next time a cop stops you for speeding. Say, I made a mistake, officer. What is 90 miles an hour on a 50 mile? It was a mistake. Okay, I won't do it again. So you see right there, it's being filtered out. 50 years from now, any historian who consults the newspapers around Richard Nixon's death is not going to get an inkling of a whole dimension of his policies. Historians are fond of telling us that history reflects the age in which it's written. Our perception of the past is heavily influenced by our experience in the present. Indeed, Benedetto Croce made the famous statement, all history is contemporary, along with Croce, Collingwood, quote, I quote Collingwood. We studied Collingwood in grad school, I remember, in my methods class, we all read it, oh, yes. Collingwood, quote, St. Augustine looked at Roman history from the point of view of an early Christian. Taillemont, from that of a 17th century Frenchman. Gibbon, from that of an 18th century Englishman. But there's something left unsaid here. People in any particular age do not perceive the past in complete agreement. In fact, they don't even perceive the present, their own particular experiences, in complete agreement. So why should we think they agree about the past? The differences range, therefore, not only across the ages and between nationalities and civilizations, but within any one society. Gibbon was not just an 18th century Englishman, but an 18th century English gentleman, well-educated and conservative, who lived comfortably and occasionally hobnobbed with nobility. A white male, prosperous enough to spend nearly 20 years of his life writing his magnum opus, The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. He might have had a much different view, by the way, of ancient Rome if he had been an impoverished, self-educated cobbler trying to write history in his spare hours late at night in a coal shed. He might have maybe said something about the slaves, you know, and the oppression or something. And by the way, it's no accident that Gibbon wasn't a cobbler or a day laborer. Poor people have neither the time nor money to produce historical tomes. Neither then nor usually today. And this leads us to another point. If there's a variety of perspectives in a society, the one most likely to prevail is not necessarily most representative of the people, but of the select few who are materially endowed. History, ladies and gentlemen, history is written by those who can afford to write it. And and if it's true that people tend to perceive reality, both past and present, in accordance with the position they occupy in the social structure, then it's likely that most of the history that has been handed down to us is affluent white gentlemen's history. I mean, most of it, by the way, was intended to be read by affluent white gentlemen at elite schools, so it's not too much to conclude that it was written by the same social group. With every conscious intent or unconscious inclination, I mean, that'd be conscious, it could be unconscious, part of the whole breeding and training and education, to reaffirm the existing social order as the best of all possible arrangements. So we have what I call dominant history in the first chapter of this new book I'm writing. In fact, you're hearing a good deal of the first chapter of this new book I'm writing. Consider how the Middle Ages are perceived. History books tell us that the Middle Ages were deeply concerned with that the people in the Middle Ages were deeply concerned with religion. Well, the historian E.H. Carr raises an interesting question. He says, I wonder how we know this. I wonder if it's true. I mean, someone of his stature raising that question. I wonder if it's true. What we know as the facts of medieval history have almost all been selected for us by generations of chroniclers who were professionally occupied in the theory and practice of religion, and who therefore thought it supremely important and recorded everything relating to religion and not much else. I'm quoting Carr. He goes on. The picture of the Russian peasant as devoutly religious was destroyed by the revolution of 1917. You know, the peasants start killing the priests and burning down the churches and doing things like that, which devout people don't usually do. The picture, Carr goes on, the picture of medieval man as devoutly religious, whether true or not, is indestructible because nearly all the known facts about him were pre-selected for us by people who believed it and wanted others to believe it. A mass of other facts in which we might possibly have found evidence to the contrary has been lost beyond recall. It is the religious scribes who wrote history, so they wrote it religious, as from the religious perspective. By the way, this historic fact is entombed in the very French word clerc, which can mean a clergyman, a scholar, or a clerk. And during the Middle Ages, they tend to be, you know, all one and the same. I think even in English, clerical as an adjective can mean clerical, administrative, or it could mean clerical interest, the clerical orders of, I think, I should have looked that up. Okay, this being the case, the peasants had virtually no opportunity to speak for themselves. When I wrote this all down, this is my own summation, I note, by the way, there are historical studies concerning peasant communities in the Middle Ages, but very little direct testimony by the peasants. They are the muted masses you don't hear. Then as I was sitting there, I was finished with Carr, I thought, wait a minute. A few years after Carr wrote, there was a remarkable publication that came out. It was the Inquisition Register of Jacques Fournier, Bishop of Pamiers, transcribed in 1318 to 1325 at Montaillou, a village in southern France. And it was retrieved from the Vatican Library in the 1960s, and it was the three surviving volumes. There were originally five. We don't know where the other two are. And they were published complete in French, I believe. A subsequent sociological study by Emmanuel Leroy Ladurie developed from the volumes offered a vivid and detailed description of peasant life and attitudes. What it was several years of inquisitional hearings in this village in the regions in which they questioned the peasants at great length. Again, the source is what? A religious one. It's a total monopoly. They're the ones who wrote it all down. But this time there was direct testimony, very rich testimony by the peasants on how they lived. And La Durie's book happened to be right on my shelf over there called Montaillou. And I raced over and picked it up and I started going through it. I spent the rest of the night reading the whole book. And the Montaillou study reveals a people who were concerned about with much else besides religion. Property, farming, pastures, livestock, cooperative communal services, crafts, festivals, courtship, marriage, family relations, personal friendships, love affairs, including cohabitation without benefit of marriage. One woman testified that her lovemaking, with a priest no less, was not a sin and did not displease God because, quote, I liked it. Well, cynic that I am, I immediately suspected that the priest gave her that line, you know, that unusual theology. But I was wrong. I was wrong because she went on to testify in perfect sincerity. She said that now that she no longer sleeps with him and doesn't like sleeping with him, it would be a consummation without pleasure. It would be, in her term, a cold consummation, and that would be sinful. Very interesting. These peasants knew a thing or two about life. The peasants in 1318 wept more easily than we do generally, both in happiness and sorrow, and they usually were loving toward their children. Less than half of the Montaigu parishioners attended church. Now, there's an interesting datum. Less than half of them attended, and many of those who did so without any special enthusiasm. One villager remarked to a group of men in the community, quote, instead of burning heretics, they ought to burn Bishop Fournier himself because he demands that we pay tithes in lambs. The bishop was ripping off their lambs, their sheep. By the way, Fournier himself became Pope Benedict VII. This statement was treated as a blasphemy against God, but in fact it was a secular criticism. It was a class protest about class exploitation. In fact, much of the heresy in Montaigu was anti-clericalism. That's all it was. It stemmed less from theological fervor and the search for salvation and more from egalitarian rejection of the lies, corruptions, privileges, and economic thievery of the upper clergy. So, I mean, I get the impression I got is that not so much, these peasants were not so much involved in church affairs as the church was involved in their affairs. They didn't fear God, they feared the Inquisition. So Professor Carr's suspicions seem to be confirmed by Professor Ladurie's in-depth view of peasant life. But the point to remember for the purpose of the present argument is that the evidence regarding Montaigu is not likely to overturn the dominant history, the one that treats the feudal peasantry as composed of devout, simple, stolid serfs. The prevailing image is of the masses as more or less accepting their station in life in a symbiotic relationship with their superiors. And by the way, this was the image created by the churchmen themselves, an image of the common people that is preferred to this day by elitist scribes and Pharisees. So it cannot be said too many times, the writing of history has been and still is principally an elitist undertaking, a privilege of the victor written from within the court, the church, government, the academy. It was Caesar and not those he vanquished who chronicled the conquest of Gaul. But who speaks then for the people of history? Through the centuries, there have been scarcely anyone to record their glory and their miseries. No one to take note of the Roman commoners who wept for loved ones lost in Caesar's wars, the peaceful villages obliterated by the conqueror's holocaust, the women torn from their hearths and homes by the military rapists and plunderers. We hear of the glories of Charlemagne, the first Holy Roman Emperor, but we don't hear of the men who enslaved and who died, worked to death in Charlemagne's mines. Came from Eastern Europe, most of them. Few chroniclers over the centuries have recorded how the course of history was changed by the women and men who created the crafts and generated the skills of civilization, who developed horticulture and designed the first wagons, seafaring vessels, fishing nets, the first looms, lathes, kilns, who cultivated the first orchards, terraces, vineyards, and invented the written word, those who did what Thorsten Veblen, the great American economist, called the work of civilization. And by the way, he had in mind mostly women who did that in most of these societies. Because the men were usually out bashing little animals in the brush or each other or hanging around. Not then or not now are they celebrated for their contributions to history. I'm reminded of the poem by Bertolt Brecht. It's called A Worker Reads History. I'll quote just the first part of it. Who built the seven gates of Thebes? The books are filled with names of kings. Was it kings who hauled the craggy rocks of stone? And Babylon, so many times destroyed, who built the city up each time? In which of Lima's houses, that city glittering with gold, lived those who built it? In the evening, when the Chinese wall was finished, where did the masons go? Giving the people their due involves more than just giving them credit for doing the burdensome work of the work of civilization. A people's history, I think, should also recognize that the people were the source. They were the source of most of the skills, discoveries, inventiveness, and positive contributions that made life bearable and even possible. It was the anonymous masses of people that gave us civilization, that gave us whatever productivity and comforts that we have. It wasn't the elites, it wasn't the rulers. They were too busy expropriating the surplus value to build their castles, to build their gold crowns, to wage their wars, to kill and plunder. Their inventiveness went into catapults and cannon and new forms of swords and steel and Gatling guns and gunboats and all the other instruments of destruction, nuclear missiles, and so it is on to today. Anything that has been progressive and whole and human has come from the people themselves, common people. Anything that's been life-destroying, for the most part, has come from those elites whose goal is to expropriate the wealth, the labor, the land, and the resources of people so that they could live better and better and better. I don't want to take it. To the princes and presidents and plutocrats and prime ministers and popes, to them we owe the horrors of war and conquest, the technologies of destruction and control, the rapacious expropriation that's enriched the few and impoverished the many through so many ages. A people's history should give us two things. First, an uncompromising account of the crimes of ruling interests, so much of which has been ignored or glossed over by mainstream historians. Second, a full account of the struggles of the common people of history to endure, confront, and sometimes rise against enormous oppression, a subject that mainstream history, dominant history, seldom mentions except passingly, and by the way, sometimes even disapprovingly. I found in a Marxist library in Berkeley, the Nibel Proctor Library, two interesting volumes, old volumes, by Osborne Ward called The Ancient Lowly, published in 1888. It's an amazing work because it's about trade unions and guilds and strikes and rebellions in the ancient world that we had no idea existed. You know, ancient Rome, they had trade unions, they had strikes, they fought for the rights of the common people. Class struggle was the name of the game even then. And I was intrigued when I opened it up. I knew I had to get my own copy. I finally did. I did a rare book search and I got them. I was intrigued by the publisher's note, preface to the fourth edition, which began as follows. I'll just read the opening sentence. The first editions of Osborne Ward's great work were printed and circulated privately, because no capitalist publisher would take the responsibility for so revolutionary a book, and no socialist publishing house existed. A socialist cooperative did come into existence and finally published the book publicly 20 years after it was written. Boyes and Moraes, their book, Labor's Untold Story, that had to get published. Who keeps that in print? I'll tell you who publishes that. It's a terrific book. It's about the untold story of American labor, the struggle, the fights against the bosses, the struggles and fights against racism, sexism, the struggles for decent wage, the untold story that most people, including people in labor, don't know, a story. That was published by the United Electrical Radio and Machine Workers Union, UE. They published it, a lefty union. In the United States, the dramatic struggles of working people extending over the better part of three centuries are absent from most history texts. So are the armed accounts of the armed revolts of farmers and slaves beginning in the late 1600s and continuing through the next two centuries, the courageous struggles of the abolitionists, When I was a kid in school, the abolitionists were like troublemakers. That's where I learned about them. They kind of like pushy troublemakers who didn't respect institutions or something. The brave experiments at interracial cooperation and democracy during Reconstruction after the Civil War. That's an untold story. I never learned about it. Not in grade school, not in high school, not in university, and not in graduate school. The great industrial strikes of the 19th and 20th centuries by railroad and steel workers, tens of thousands of them, hundreds of thousands, by packing house employees, mill hands, coal miners, and others. Dominant history has very little to say about the pitched battles between workers and militia, the factory takeovers, and the murder of strikers by company gun thugs, police, and the U.S. Army. Samuel Eliot Morrison. There are a couple of my favorites that are really reliable if you ever want to get perfect examples of the misrepresentation, the blather and pap of official dominant history. Two of my two favorites are Samuel Eliot Morrison and Daniel Boorstein. And Eliot Morrison wrote a book, 1,122-page tome called The Oxford History of the American People, a book to be seriously avoided. Has nothing, or very little to say about these struggles. Not a word about the champions of labor, such as John Swinton, Albert Parsons, Jacob Coxey, Henry George, W.E.B. Du Bois, Big Bill Haywood, Clarence Darrow, Mother Jones, Carlo Tresca, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, Emma Goldman. Not a word. I looked in the index. Not one of them appear. In 1,122 pages, he couldn't find any room for that. Morrison's history is a celebration of establishment leadership, a compilation of Eurocentric ruling class apologetics. A study of 17 widely used high school history texts. And if you want to see what happens to history when it gets retailed and mass marketed, you have to look at the history texts. Covering the period from the Civil War to World War I, the author of the study, Jean Anion, notes that all these textbooks are marketed by a publishing industry that is big business, with annual sales of several billion dollars, owned by corporate conglomerates like CBS, IBM, Xerox, and Gulf and Weston. The textbooks, she notes, are, while claiming objectivity, all have ideological slants that tend to be pro-business and anti-labor. They all have a remarkable similarity of vocabulary, and they all are remarkably similar, I'm quoting her, remarkably similar in the judgments they come to. And by the way, this remarkable ideological homogenization, the more the homogenization, the more the claim to objectivity. Because what they do is they equate homogenization. If everybody's saying the same thing, then it's objective. If it's all within the established way. If you say something different that's a little jarring, then that is then that becomes questionable. And it's what Alvin Guldner called the background assumptions, that our tendency to accept a datum or an argument as true or not depends less on the content and substance of it than it does on how congruent it is with the background assumptions we already have. But those background assumptions are, of course, established by the whole climate of opinion and the whole universe of communication that we are immersed in and constantly hear. Which is why dissidents learn the discipline of fighting and developing their arguments and arguing from evidence, while those who work within the safe mainstream work with a whole lifetime with unexamined assumptions and presumptions. The textbooks... This is a pretty intelligent crowd for that line to get an applause. I like that. That was good. Must be a few really militant dropouts here. All these textbooks that Jean Anion investigated, it devote a lot of space to industrial development and presume that it was a good thing for the general populace. All of them either completely ignore or gloss lightly over the staggering human costs that were inflicted upon millions of working women, children, and men. Low wages are attributed in some of the books to the willingness of unskilled immigrants to work for subsistence pay, rather than to the owner's determined power to impose low wages. 12 of the books took no notice of the American Socialist Party. 4 or 5 of the remaining dismissed the socialists and said they only had a small number of adherents. They were a small little group. This is, by the way, a party that, before World War I, had elected 1,200 socialists in public office in U.S. cities, to state legislatures, even one or two in Congress who weren't allowed to sit. Also 79 mayors in 24 states. The socialist labor leader, Eugene Victor Debs, ran for president in 1912, and he received almost 1 million votes. It probably was over 1 million if he had gotten an honest count. This was the year when Woodrow Wilson was elected president on 6 million. So Debs getting 1 million, that was quite a bit. All these textbooks just brush off the socialists as a little inconsequential group that nobody really, just a little kind of funny little cult there. By the way, all the industrialists of the late 19th century launched themselves into business either with inherited wealth or by gaining access to large loans or by ripping off the government, profiteering during the Civil War or acquiring government funds and land from the government. But these textbooks that she studied, Jean Anion, she points out that the ideological and historically false view that the books offer an ideologically and historically false view of how wealth was accumulated. One of the favorite examples they gave was of Andrew Carnegie. Andrew Carnegie, a number of the texts said, started out on $1.20 a week. And he supported a whole family on that. And he managed to save. See? You don't save. He managed to save enough money, and when he got enough saved on that $1.20, he invested it and made a fortune. This could make an animated movie, maybe, but this... in fact, Carnegie's investment, his initial capital came from a loan he got from a very rich friend. The facts aren't even right. I mean, they're just not right. Aside from what they omit and what they do say are terrible distortions. During this period of this study, of the books covered in the study, the Civil War to World War I, there were over 30,000 strikes in the United States. Almost none of them mentioned in the books. A few mentioned of them, like the Pullman strike, the Haymarket, because there was some violence and people were killed. Those are mentioned. And generally, the impression given is that strikes are not something very good for workers to do, because it's harmful to them and it's really not in their interests. Now, these high school history texts are probably the only history that most Americans will ever read. And Anion concludes that the books served more as legitimators for the existing corporate order than as sources of critical and independent investigation. And there are similar, as you know, similar critical studies done on textbooks and how they treat the whole subject of race relations and racism and gender relations. Well, the mass marketing of textbooks reveals then what's called the mass marketing of history. Ideas and information are not disseminated democratically in our allegedly democratic society. This is as true of history as it's true of current events. History is written and popularized by those who control the communication universe. And that's the point that historians never make. When they write about what is history, the making of history, the writing of history, if you read Collingwood, read Croce, read C. Van Woodward, read Hexter, a number of them, they're talking about how the historian should do this, do that, be close to his materials, but preserve his objectivity as best he can, all these do's and don'ts. What they don't talk about is how is that history marketed? How do you then get, after you write this thing, how do you get it to audiences, you see? And the assumption is that any history that any number of historians write has an equal chance to reach any kind of audiences, and that's just not true. I mean, why are Morrison and Boorstin celebrated historians? Why do they get rewards? Boorstin's now head of the Library of Congress, isn't he? Morrison was head of the AHA for years. Why? They're given grants. They're given special contracts to write special kinds of books. They're given all sorts of awards. Why not? Why has none of that ever gone to, say, Philip Foner or Herbert Aptheker or people who have written history from the bottom up, or Jesse Lemish, people like that? I would say the class interests... It depends on the class interest that they speak for. Foner and Aptheker, Boyer and Moraes speak for different kinds of class interests. They don't write history for the powers that be. They don't get awards. They don't get prestigious positions, lush grants, media access. Herbert Aptheker, in 60 years, has never gotten one regular university appointment. Why is it Fogel and Engerman, their book, Time on the Cross, about slavery? I think it was Jules Lester who years ago wrote a critique of Time on the Cross. He called it, the title of his review was Fun on the Cross. And it was a book about how, really, when you read it closely, slavery wasn't all that bad. The slaves learned new skills. Their actual level of development was advanced as compared to what it had been in Africa. I mean, there's all sorts of things. This book got all sorts of rewards. 1920? When was this? 1910? Jim Crow days? No. This was about 5 years, 6 years ago. No, I'm sorry. I take that back. This was in 79, 80. It was more like 14 years ago. Why is it that book got all that celebrity? Why is it Herb Gutman? Herbert Gutman wrote an answer to Fogel and Engerman. He called it Slavery and the Numbers Game, how they finessed statistics and all that sort of thing. He took them apart, layer by layer. How is it? We never hear of his book. His book is published by an obscure little house. Gutman talked about the horrors of slavery. You can go on. Why is Alistair Horne's book, The Fall of Paris? That book is a book about the Paris Commune, 71, 72, when the workers of Paris, the first revolution where they actually took over Paris and held it for months against the capitalist class, against the Thiers army, against the Prussians, with such courage and determination. A book written by Alistair Horne, that's the only book on the Paris Commune that's been in print. It's been in print for 30 years, and it hates the Paris Commune. It writes about it like they're a bunch of confused idiots. They happen to have a few cannon, and they got carried away. It says nothing about what the grievances of the workers were, what the essence of their struggle was. That's the one I find on the Paris Commune. I can't find any other book, any in print paperback on that subject. So history is marketed in a certain way. There's another teacher of history I haven't mentioned, and that's the media. The news media, you know, we always say that, you know, the memory of most news media people goes back about 3 weeks. But, you know, in some instances that isn't always true. They know how to do history in a certain way. They're corporate-owned and controlled conglomerates that faithfully reflect in content or by omission the ideological biases and presuppositions of the very corporate world of which they are an integral part. Well, you look at the media. Well, yeah, you gave example, Richard Nixon, other things like that. No. They even do things about events from 500 years ago. The anniversary of Christopher Columbus discovering America. Remember that one? They were out there talking about what an all right guy he was, and it didn't happen that he slaughtered and enslaved people. He didn't do those things. He did do those things. He wrote about them in his journal. He wrote about these people. By the way, he didn't think they were such bad people. He said these natives, these dark skinned natives, were very gracious, very intelligent, very nice, very trusting, very innocent, Your Highness. They'll make great slaves. So, I mean, their humanity was an opportunity for him to pursue that thing that drives so many people, that makes them lose their souls and their humanity. It's called self-interest, aggrandizing yourself at the expense of other human beings and other lives. That has been one of the motor impulses and horrors of history. And our only hope is that people defend themselves against it. So you had the media saturated with this stuff. blocking out the fact that there were all sorts of people who were coming along and saying, we've had enough about Columbus. We want to give you another side to Columbus and what it all meant. That he did not discover America. He began what was called the conquest of America. There already were people here. They were not a scattered few tribes around, as Parrington and other historians have said. And Francis Kenny does a beautiful job on that. He points out how these guys actually finessed the figures. They knew. And they knew, and they didn't publish the honest figures, that there were millions, that the population of North America, of North Native American Indians, was millions more, by a factor over 100 or 1,000 more than they said. There were maybe as many as 10 or 15 or 20 million people living on this continent when Columbus came. They had societies and they had civilizations, and those first settlers wouldn't have survived if they didn't learn from the expertise of the Indians, the Native Americans, who helped them and gave them food and showed them how to plant and showed them things about things that were going on. The settlements that refused to have anything to do with the Indians died. Jamestown, every single person died because they would have nothing to do with the Indians. They were going to survive on their own. They couldn't. In fact, there was a conquest of America, a forcible, brutal, violent conquest of America. And that story, you think the media would get excited about that, right? Hey, a new story, a new angle. Hey, we only publish man bites dog, right? We don't publish dog bites man. Well, all right, here's something new and different and unusual. No, very hard to get in, I can tell you that. The French Revolution. Remember the Bicentennial in 1989. That was interesting. I got an interesting little file on it. I don't want to go through it. That's another whole talk. But it was a revolution that should not have occurred, I start hearing. This is amazing. A revolution of irrational excesses. That's an amazing thing, you know. The first great democratic revolution, successful revolution on the continent of Europe, the opening of a whole new age of republics, the victory of republicanism over monarchy, finally, the victory over medieval clerical clergy control and corruption, all those things. This great democratic revolution, liberté, fraternité, égalité, they're talking about it now. It would have been better off if it hadn't happened. If King Louis had been allowed to carry on his reign, it had been gradual, slow change and all things in their time. The media fabricate history not only in the news but in entertainment. Look at the horrors, the dreadful horrors of slavery, enslaving other human beings, using them as property, selling, dividing families off and selling them off. Birth of the Nation, Griffiths, Gone with the Wind, the TV series called North and South. Did anybody ever see that miniseries? And it came back, North and South Part 2, as if Part 1 wasn't bad enough. You had scenes of the Confederate gentleman at his plantation on his horse, and he's saying, I've got to go, Annie Mae, June, April. And she says, what, must you go, Clayton? He says, yes, I've got to go, ma'am. I've got to go to defend our way of life. And I'm sitting there saying, what way of life? That's a way of life? What would you want to explain or fill in a little bit about your way of life? You know, the bullwhip, selling children off from their mothers. How about telling us a little more? Working them from dawn to dusk, cutting the rations of old slaves when they couldn't work hard anymore. None of that got into North and South. I mean, if I had gone down there and said, could I volunteer to write some of the script, and I wrote some of it, they'd say, you're being ideological. I think you're losing your objectivity here. Look, this is art. We don't want to propagandize. I'm the propagandist. The truth is propaganda, and your propaganda is seen as objective entertainment, whatever the hell that is. The way imperialism has been portrayed in the media. Militarism, whites slaughtering the savage hordes in the Transvaal. It could be in the middle of the African jungles. It could be on the plains of North America. It could be off in Asia, wherever it was. But there was always these whites, the human beings, the star actors, and they were killing off these mad hordes. In other words, standing history on its head, you know, reversing the roles of victim and victimizer. Because it was the savage hordes that were coming to kill them. I mean, all their killing was done in self-defense. The nice white people in the fort or the encampment or in the wagon circle. Absolutism, autocracy over revolution. The media. Tales of Two Cities, Scarlet Pimpernel. Three sequels to the Scarlet Pimpernel. Scarlet Pimpernel Returns, Scarlet Pimpernel 2, Son of the Pimpernel. I'm not making those up. And one remake of the Scarlet Pimpernel. All these, by the way, coming out in 1989, the bicentennial of the French Revolution. There were so many Scarlet Pimpernel stories about the brave French aristocrat who's saving people from the guillotine. And the common people are portrayed as bloodlusting, crude people. Well, we'll get you, you know, and that sort of thing. They let you know who the good guys and the bad guys were. The good guys were the aristocrats, the guys with the profiles, you know, who talked in those resonant tones and so caring and loving and refined, you know. Of course you're going to root for them. The French finally made a movie called Danton, which was about Danton being a good guy. Robespierre just sits there like that. They let one line out where Robespierre says, and I felt the movie audience stir, like they a little flicker of the truth. They didn't know about that. Robespierre finally turns. You know, he's portrayed, the way history has portrayed Robespierre, as just some guy who likes to send people to the guillotine. And he says, we have to continue. We have to fight the bankers, just the bankers. And the rich will destroy us if we don't preserve this struggle for the people. And there's a line, something like that, not even quite that good. And the audience goes, hey, Robespierre, what was he about? You couldn't find out from this movie. You just found out that he was a kind of a cold guy. Well, Danton was played by Gérald Depardieu. He was going, hey, hello, hey, you know, you got to love him, you know, of course. The same Danton who said the revolution should belong to the people who make the revolution. Let's enjoy it and let's get ours now. That was the hero. Anti-communism, how the entertainment media portrays that, I won't even begin that. You certainly have known that for a long time. I want to wind it up. I've talked too long. I'm sorry. The successful control of history can be measured in the results. U.S. citizens seem to know very little about real history. A survey of college students found that high percentages of them, didn't know the difference between World War I and World War II, although they had a suspicion that World War II came after World War I. Many Americans, something like 20% in the poll, 20, 30% believe that Germany and the Soviet Union were allies in World War II. I think Ronald Reagan thinks that too. By the way, that's not a function of ignorance. You know, that's information. When they say the Germans and the Russians were allies in World War II, they have an information of a sort. They have disinformation. It's a function of the miseducation, the constant carping on the Hitler-Stalin pact. They never call it the Hitler-Chamberlain pact. They always call that Munich. That was a real sellout where he sold out Czechoslovakia, where the Soviets were willing and said, we'll defend Czechoslovakia and we'll fight on your side against the Nazis. They never mentioned that, by the way. They call it an alliance. Stalin never made an alliance with Hitler. He made a pact. No more than if the U.S. signed a pact with the Soviet Union would that have mean that we were allies with them. It was a pact to buy time and stall them off and hope that Hitler would go west instead of come east. But that whole harping made them convince as many people that the Germans and the Soviets were allies in World War II. Many Americans, very high percentage, have never heard of Hiroshima. I have no idea that the United States dropped an atomic bomb on that city. Many could not tell you what issues were involved in the Vietnam War or other armed conflicts in which the U.S. has participated. You can forgive them for that one, almost, given the amount of obfuscation there. Nor can they say much about the history of aggression perpetrated against Native Americans and the slavery inflicted upon Africans in America. The centuries of imperialism imposed on Asia, Africa, and Latin America by the European and North American powers is also a huge chapter that's unknown. Imperialism. If that was a little spasm of something we did back around the Spanish-American War with Teddy Roosevelt just for a couple of years, and then we got over it. Now, Americans are not totally to blame for this. They're taught almost nothing about these things in school. and what they are taught is usually devoid of the urgent political economic realities. What little history they do learn has almost no political economic reality that would allow both the past and the present to inform each other, and that would make history meaningful and exciting to us. Well, Parenti, I mean, why?